Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their communities. How are you doing today? How's your week been? It is dark and cloudy and rainy here in Victoria, but that's okay because it's been really, really dry. And I have work to do, so I can't go outside and sit on a sunny bench and sun myself and look at the flowers. I got to get to work. I got a podcast to do. Today on the show, I talk with Stephen Knight, who is a baker with a very interesting career, an interesting life. He's a baker out of Seattle. Going to talk to him in a few minutes here. Before then, just thought I'd make sure you're doing all right. To my American friends who aren't sick of COVID or worried about fires or watching the news, or, well, especially if you're watching the news, my gosh, I feel bad for you. All I can do is to offer up, talk to your neighbors, talk to your family, give them big hugs, because I can't imagine that the people immediately around you are as mean as the folks on the news. I've been avoiding it. I've been on full media lockdown since the 18th of September, except I shouldn't really do that, because I walked past a newsstand yesterday and there was a thing about on the front page about a provincial election in BC, the province where I live. And so I guess a full media lockdown is a bad thing, because you miss the local politics and the fact that we're in a month, we're going to have a provincial election. I should figure out who I'm going to vote for here, because it's Canadian politics. Although there are people that are trying, it's not as sort of Marvel Comics version as it is, say, in the States or in England, where one side is so clearly portrayed as evil and malignant in all ways, and the other side is just wonderful and angelic. And it doesn't really matter what your beliefs are. There is a side for you to hate in some other countries, and I think that's sad. Justified, maybe, at times, but still sad that it's come to that and that it's portrayed as that. What else to talk about? Oh, I should tell you about this. Why not? So for those of you that listen to the podcast, and I know sourdough baking is just like, oh my gosh, it's the knitting of 2020. It's the COVID. It's knitting a cap during COVID instead of knitting everybody's making sourdough bread, which I think is amazing. But there's still an awful lot of mystery around, oh, making your own starter and perpetuating it and that kind of thing. So I just got to tell you, I wasn't happy with my starter, so I threw it out and I started a brand new one. I always use the starting proportions that are described in Jeffrey Hamelman's book, but I made this starter. It's doing great. I baked 4 loaves over the weekend in my Challenger bread pan. And they did really, really well. They're gorgeous. They're gorgeous loaves, because the way the cast iron pan works and stuff is absolutely stunning. But the flavor is amazing. It's not too sour. It rose in a decent amount of time, even though it's only a week old starter. And so I'm a happy guy, because for the starter to take off that quick in my apartment and to be bakeable, you know, in 4 days, that kind of a thing, just tells me that We're getting a bit of a culture in my kitchen that supports wild yeast and the lactobacteria and that kind of thing, which always makes me happy. It's not a sterile environment where I live. So I don't know. Maybe that's weird, but I like to think that when they say you've got baking in your blood, I think what that really means is, you know, you've got wild yeast in your hands and in the air. And so they've made a home in my new apartment, which makes me very, very happy. And the bread was good too. Although I have to say there's something going on with my oven, because the bread baked in the Challenger bread pan is amazing in every way, but the bottom of the loaves really scorch. Like they get really, really dark. And I think it's just because my oven, that bottom element is just way overpowered compared to the top or something like that. I'm not blaming the pan at all because everything scorches even in a half sheet pan. But I've tried like adding parchment and that doesn't make any difference. And then the last loaf of bread that I baked out of the four that I made, I did two on Saturday, two on Sunday. That last loaf, inspired by the dudes that were on the show last week from Boulder, Colorado, the guys at Ferment, because I saw in one of their videos that they start their bread in the cast iron in like the crock pot kind of thing, and then take it out when it's par-baked and put it on a pizza stone to finish it off, because that's all they have room for in their oven. And I thought, well, that's a pretty cool idea, so I'm going to try that. I'm inspired by these guys. I'm going to try that. So I par-bake the loaf in the Challenger bread pan, you know, for 25 minutes, and then I try and take it out of the pan and put it just on the rack to finish off to see if that's going to solve my scorching problem. I can report two things. First off, it doesn't solve the scorching problem at all, which tells me I have a very hot bottom element on my oven. And the other thing is 25 minutes is not enough par baking time for my loaves, because they were very, very delicate still. And I tried my best to, you know, to pick them up out of the pan and put them on the rack without squishing them or dropping them or whatever. But let's just say I failed in that and I've got a pretty saggy loaf. It fell pretty good in the last 10 minutes to finish it off. So not all experiments work, but that's why they're experiments. And I learned from that. So I think the next thing I'm going to try and do is do the par bake for like 25 minutes. And when I take the dome off the oven, off the bread pan, and let it finish off and get its color, I think I might just turn the oven off and kill the heat on that bottom burner and see if that affects the scorching at all. Because it is kind of excessive in my oven. You know, I'm not super fussy, but this is pretty dark and pretty deep into the loaf. It's not just a little surface flash, if that makes sense. Anyway, what else to tell you? Oh yeah, one more thing. I'm shipping this podcast. Will be released on the 23rd of September, which is Wednesday, in the morning. And that afternoon, we're having a baker roundtable call for Bakers for Bakers, because we have them twice a month, usually on Wednesday afternoon specific time, because it's early morning in Australia and it's early evening, and it's still possible it's later at night in Europe, but there's sort of an opportunity for people from all over to attend, more or less, as best I can, but it's sort of a sweet spot there. And so, yeah, we're going to have this talk this afternoon, and it's going to be a lot of fun and very informative and very heartwarming to connect with other bakers from around the world. And so we do these twice a month. If you'd like to be part of it, all you have to do is sign up for Bakers for Bakers at bakers4bakers.org. It's free to sign up. Come join the community, join in, tell us about yourself, answer questions, ask questions, all of that. And then twice a month, you can come on these calls. It's a pile of fun. So yeah, give it a shot. bakers4bakers.org. All right, on to the chat. Stephen Knight. I didn't know Stephen. He reached out to me via Instagram, and we were sort of chatting and stuff. I said, well, why don't you come on the show? And he's a really, really interesting fella, well, which you will hear about. Had a career as a musician, had a full-on career as a broadcaster and journalist, which is really cool, and then decided, you know, I think I want to get into baking, and went for it, and has worked as a professional baker for, you know, 15 years now in a variety of big name, large, you know, serious bakeries on both coasts of the U.S., which I just think is really, really neat. You know, like, anyways, you're going to hear all about it, and then we'll talk about it after. Here we go. Stephen Knight from Seattle, Washington.
Yeah. I'm curious about something. When did I take it you grew up in Regina?
Yeah. Yeah.
And when did you and your wife move to Victoria?
Just about a year ago. So 27th of September last year is when we finally made it out here. It had been in the works for a long time, but right. when our kids were smaller, it was like the grandparents were all in town and stuff. And so, you know, we wanted to stay so they were closer to their family. Right. Mm-hmm. And not take off. And then, when we closed our bakery in 2015, we thought, okay, now we're going.
How long did you have the bakery?
We had it for 5 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, the kids were in university though at the time in Regina. Right. So we said, well, you know, they're all in school. We'll hang around for a little bit longer. Right. So we figured out, you know, how to keep working and doing things for a few years after that. But quite literally their university convocation was on the 19th of June, I think it was last year. They both graduated from school. And, even though they're different ages, it took them longer times. And then they both moved away. And so it's like, okay, we put the house up for sale by the end of June. We said, if the kids aren't here, we're going. So, yeah.
And I'm curious, boys or girls, what ages? What did they study in university?
Well, my son's 25 now, and he's in Vancouver. So right, fairly close to us. He was just here this weekend. And he studied kinesiology, and he's working on getting his physiotherapy designation, right?
So okay, good for him.
I think his passion is sort of sports physio, but he's doing a lot of work now with concussions and that kind of thing, actually with the workers' compensation or WorkSafe that's here in BC are referring a lot of concussions through work injuries that they're having trouble healing. They go through the physios at the clinic he's in, and he works with them. And then my daughter, she's 23 now, and her degree is in education, arts education specifically. So teaching using all the arts. And she's over in England. She got a job in Canterbury at a school there, and she wanted to travel, and they're short of teachers in England. So she's teaching English. She's just started her second year over there, second school year teaching English to sort of middle school, early high school in North American terms. Yeah. So, and she's loving it over there. So the kids are both happy and they're doing well. So, you know,
that's marvelous. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks. How about you? Are you, you got, kids and that kind of thing?
I do. I'm somewhat older than you.
Yeah. Okay.
My wife and I, it's a second marriage. My wife and I between us have four children, three boys and a girl.
Okay.
The girl is my daughter, who is now 40,
okay,
and married, has two young boys, and she lives in a little town which is basically a ferry ride away from Seattle. She works in downtown Seattle. She's a supervising deputy prosecutor for King County, which is a county that encompasses Seattle.
Okay.
And her husband is some sort of venture capitalist lawyer.
Oh,
I don't quite understand what he does. The three boys are in, we have one still in New York with his partner, and we have another son and his wife and grandchild who just moved from New York to Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then a third son, the youngest son, who is in Atlanta.
Oh, wow. So you've got the four corners kind of covered off there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Neat.
And I was although I'm from the Seattle area and worked here for a number of years, I went back to New York in 2001, right about the time of 9/11.
Oh, dear.
Worked there for the last 15 years of my career. And then when I was able to retire from broadcasting, my wife was still working, of course, and like many people who live in New York for a time, it all of a sudden becomes just a little bit too much.
Yeah.
You know, the subways are just a little too crowded. It's just a little too hot in the summer, a little too cold in the winter. The rents are just a little bit too high. And so we had always thought that we would probably move out of New York when we got older. Right. And we looked around and said, oh, fuck it. Let's just go now. Came back to Seattle because Stephanie is here with her family.
Right.
And it has the same climate that you have in Victoria,
yeah.
You know, it's
oh, yeah.
Very mild.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been back here. It'll be 5 years in December.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
So
on.
we moved out right before Trump got elected, or right after Trump got elected.
Okay. I went to that anarchist city. As I've got a buddy Bob that lives in Seattle, and he's been posting on Facebook every once in a while, like, you know, here's a picture of his garden, you know, in the center of anarchy, or his dog, you know, that kind of thing, and just making fun of the whole the reputation that they're trying to build about cities like Seattle and Portland and stuff, right? Which are I've been to. I love them, like, just lovely places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and so is Victoria.
Oh yeah.
I'm curious why you chose Victoria over Vancouver.
Oh, I think just mainly being from a smaller city, like Regina is just around 200,000 people. We like Vancouver to visit, but thought it was a little bit too crazy to live there. And also, although it's bloody expensive to live on the island here, we thought we'd get away with it a little cheaper in Victoria than Vancouver, just compared to what my son's paying for rent and that kind of thing. But, right. But it's not that big a difference, to be honest with you. But yeah, when we moved, we really wanted to try and find a place where we could live car free for a while and try and get around on foot and on bikes and public transit and that kind of thing. So it had us thinking, okay, we want to live more downtown wherever we're living. And we thought, downtown Victoria was more walkable, a little calmer than downtown Vancouver. Although I do love it over there. Like, it's really awesome. But, just, you know, a little more mellow, and certainly this year with COVID and everything, we haven't had the tourist influx that usually comes to Victoria. There's been some, but not near as much. And so we've been kind of spoiled because, we're not hurting financially from the lack of tourists like a lot of places are. And it's not near as crowded downtown. So it's sort of, it's a guilty pleasure this year for sure. But I hope the tourists are able to come back next year, because it's going to help everybody out. Yeah.
Yeah, they will. Victoria is lovely. I haven't been there for a number of years, but I've been there several times.
Yeah.
It's a great place.
Well, we wanted to be closer to the good camping and the outdoors, and within an hour of where we live, you can get to some amazing campgrounds and stuff and cool beaches. And so we can sneak out and go tenting or whatever, or just spend a day out at a provincial park with less traffic and less hassle than if we were in downtown Vancouver, you know, like that kind of thing. So far it's working out quite well. We're loving it on the island for sure. Not getting itchy feet, and I'm, you know, I've never looked forward to fall as much as I have this year, because I know that the winter that is coming isn't going to be as brutal as what I'm used to.
Yeah. A long, long time ago, when I was in college, I actually quit. I grew up as a musician. I was a drummer.
Okay.
And so I quit college for a time and went traveling around the U.S., Mexico, and some in Canada,
okay,
playing drums. And I remember, I think it was the winter that I was in Edmonton and Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And it was so cold.
Yep.
But I finally took a look around my incipient career, and I said, you know, I really don't want to be a musician for the rest of my life. So I came back to Seattle and finished up college at the University of Washington.
Well, yeah, we were just, so where I lived was a six hour drive west of Winnipeg. So exactly the same kind of winters, you know, just right on the prairies, and where the wind all comes out of the north. And, you know, whenever it was on TV, it was like about the polar vortexes coming down and hitting everybody south of us. It's sort of like, well, okay, you know, we've been getting it all winter. It's time to spread the love a bit.
I remember the hair on my mustache would actually freeze.
Oh, yeah.
I found quite unusual, and I remember still.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So cool. Well, so what was your first career, I guess? Or I'm assuming, just because I read the email you sent me with your bio and stuff, that the that it's, I got two things in mind. Sort of, you've been baking for an awful long time now, you know, and doing a lot of different things, but it sounds like there was a career before that. What was your,
there's always a career before, I spent, just to give you some, to put things in chronological perspective, I'm 70.
Okay.
My first career, well, aside from being a musician for a number of years, I spent 43 years in broadcast news.
Oh, okay.
As radio and television anchor and reporter, working most of my career here in Seattle, and then the last 15 years of it as a network radio anchor and correspondent, mostly for CBS News back in New York.
Okay.
And so I'm, and then we came back here, you know, 5 years ago. Right. In the mid-90s, when I was working in television news, I was getting burned out on TV news, as most people do. And I read a marvelous book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which is about a quarter inch thick, written by a communications professor from Syracuse University, whose name I'll recall in a minute. But his basic thesis was that ever since the railroad and the telegraph, Americans have become more and more fascinated by information of lesser and lesser importance that comes to them from farther and farther away. And I read it and I thought to myself, oh shit, this is why I'm getting sick of TV news. And I was, because I started my career in radio and then transitioned into television. And then I transitioned back into radio here in Seattle. And spent the last 2 years here in Seattle. I was running the news department at KIRO Radio, which was the it's not all news anymore, but at the time was a news talk radio station here in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I was running the news department. And about 2 years into that, I took a look at things and I thought, you know, I'm not doing what I got into this business to do. Mm-hmm. I'm dealing with 25-year-olds who are saying, you know, I really don't want to work weekends.
Yeah.
And we were a CBS network radio affiliate.
Okay.
And so I had contact with the people back there, and they asked me if I'd like to come back and work with them. And so I packed up and moved to New York for 15 years.
Right, right. Wow.
And then while in New York, I anchored and reported both, you know, I wanted to work in national news, which is more interesting than local news.
Right.
You know, you do murders where more people are killed and politics with higher level politicians. So I did a lot of traveling. I made two trips to the Middle East when the war started.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And came home safely. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
My wife and I planned our wedding with her back home in Brooklyn and me in Baghdad.
Wow.
And right after we got married, the network said, well, we're going to send you back to Baghdad again next month. And Debbie said, no, sweetheart, I think twice is enough.
Yeah, for sure.
And so that was the only time I ever said no.
Okay.
And that's one of the, I can't recall which interviewee in one of your podcasts, I think it was Mitch Stamm, who said, never say no when there's an opportunity that comes up that might improve your career. And that's how I worked in broadcasting for 40-some years. They would say, hey, can you go to X? And I'd say, I'm on my way.
Yeah.
And then I'd gone about as far as I could in that profession. I had a network anchor position. I was staff at the time with Fox News Radio, which really was back then fair and balanced because they had so many affiliates, they couldn't really take a political position. Mm-hmm. And I was with them, and then I had the whole heart surgery thing, and here I am.
Yeah.
Let me give you just two other little bits of that.
Sure, sure.
And I hate to keep going on because we're not talking about bacon. Back in the mid-90s, I decided that I wanted to go to culinary school.
Okay.
So I went to culinary school here in Seattle, at a community college, which was at the time one of only, I think, 63 accredited culinary schools in the country.
Okay.
And my brilliant idea was not to necessarily be a cook or a chef, but to produce programming about cooking.
Okay.
That I would sell to television stations around the country. And a photographer friend and I actually produced 3 pilot segments. And the news director at the television station looked at them and said, "Those are great, but I don't see how any station would have any money to pay for them."
Okay.
And this is pre-internet.
Yeah.
And so that idea died. And in the process of doing that, I learned something actually very important for me as a baker, which is that I'm not a business person.
Yeah.
Baking or any profession, any trade, and the business side of that trade are two very different skills. You can be a great baker and a horrible businessman, and you can be a great business person and a horrible baker.
Mm-hmm.
Not very many people have both capabilities. And I was lucky in that I recognized in myself that I don't have both capabilities. And that's fine with me. I have great admiration for the people who do have both. And the best example of that I can think of is Tom Douglas.
Right.
Who's a star chef here in Seattle, for whom I worked for about 3 years in their bakery.
Yeah.
And he runs an excellent company. He knows how to do it. And it's just remarkable to see the way that's done. I have great admiration for those folks.
Yeah, for sure. Well, because just the nature of it means you've got to step away from the bench or step away from the oven a bit to just have the time to do all those other things.
Yeah.
And yet that ability to step back in, you know, whether it's just doing new recipe development or new formula development, is pretty cool that you can keep, you know, I've got a lot of admiration for folks like that too. Cause I remember when I talked to Joanne Chang and she said, well, you know, she's now up to like seven bakeries in and a restaurant in Boston. And it's like, well, what's your day like now, right? Like you can't possibly be baking anymore. And she's like, yeah, you get to raise it up a level. You get to do new testing and try new things, but really it's all about setting culture and stuff. And so I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Zachary Gulper?
I am by the name, but I haven't met him and I haven't, you know, kind of been
okay.
Zachary, in touch with that. Yeah.
Zachary is, I think he won the James Beard Award for Best Baker once or twice.
True. Yeah.
He's a very interesting guy. He opened his bakery in Brooklyn in what used to be called, it was a bookstore called Heights Books. And he opened up in 2011, which is right about the time I was thinking that I'd like to transition out of broadcasting and into baking. And so I went in and I said, "Hey, Zachary, how'd you like to hire me as an intern, a stagiaire?" Yeah. And so I worked for him for about 3 months or so, right after he opened. And there was one morning when I had to get something in the office, and I went down and the light was off, and I tripped over him. He was asleep on the floor.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty good example of what it's like when you open a bakery. And later on, as we were working one time, he was thinking of expanding. And what most bakeries in New York do, because space is so limited, if they want to expand, they get a space to build yes. a production kitchen.
Yep.
And I know you're somewhat familiar with New York.
Mm-hmm.
Zachary's bakery was in Borough Hill, which is not too far away. It's walking distance from downtown Brooklyn. And he opened a production bakery in a place called Industry City, which is east and south of where he is along the waterfront. And there are a couple of three different production bakeries down there. And he and I were talking, and I said, "Zachary, if you're not careful," because he really is an excellent, excellent baker. I said, "Zachary, if you're not careful, pretty soon you're going to have a bunch of different stores and a production bakery, and you're not going to touch dough at all."
Right.
And he's, since then, I haven't spoken with him for years, but he's been very, very successful. But I don't imagine that he spends a great deal of time touching dough anymore. Sure. Mm-hmm. And I would miss that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's why a lot of the bakery owners I know that have got more than one, you know, location or a larger operation, they end up teaching classes and stuff because at least they can keep their hands in it, you know, on the weekends or something like that, right? Like, you know, I've taken a couple classes from Amy Sherber and you know Amy, don't you? Yeah.
I worked for Amy at Amy's Breads.
Yeah.
For a period of time.
What was that like?
It was great. We were, I worked on, for your listeners who may not have heard all your podcasts.
Right.
Amy opened up Amy's Breads at a little bakery on 8th Avenue in Manhattan, in Midtown Manhattan. She expanded then to a facility in, what's it called? Spice Market?
Yeah, Chelsea Market, right?
Down in Chelsea. Yeah, Chelsea Market, that's it. And then she expanded some years ago to a big production bakery in Long Island City. And it's a big place. They put out a whole lot of product. And I followed Judith Norell's advice.
Okay.
When she said to me, you should go to Amy's Breads and spend some time on the shaping table. And so I was fresh out of school and hired on as a shaper at Amy's Breads. And I was on the baguette team. And we did, I think, 1,500 pounds of baguette dough in an 8-hour shift.
Yikes.
And it would be a matter of, with a team, you know, shaping, you let it proof, you sweep the floor, then you go in and you bake it. As it cools, then you pack it, and then you take a break, and then you do the whole thing all over again.
Wow.
And that was my first experience in a large production facility like that.
Yeah.
And it was way different than what we had at school, because in school, you're doing everything by hand.
Yeah.
There is no baguette rolling machine. There are no dough dividers. And you work, like most students do, very carefully and very slowly.
Right.
And so I was at Amy's to get my speed up, which I did. Mm-hmm. It was great.
Yeah.
To give you a little background of the schooling part of my bread education. I went to the International Culinary Center in New York, which is in Soho, which has since closed because of the COVID crisis.
Okay.
And they've merged with another cooking school in New York called the International, it's ICE, I-C-E. Okay. I always get the names confused.
Sure.
Anyway, we had 12 people in our class. It was an 11-week class, very intensive. Our instructor was Jonathan Wu, who was one of the founding bakers of Bouchon Bakery.
Okay.
So he really, really knew his stuff.
Yeah.
And I went to bread school at an advanced age because I really wanted to learn the basics.
Sure.
Which I did. And then after school, I worked for a time at Le Pain Quotidien.
Okay.
Where Judith also worked. Many of the former ICC students worked at Le Pain because it was just around the corner, basically. I worked there. I did a long internship at Bread's Bakery. I worked at a place in Brooklyn called Baked, which was more of a pastry dessert place.
Yeah.
And then I worked at Amy's Breads, and then we moved back here to Seattle.
Right.
And then when we got into Seattle, I made some inquiries and hired on at Dahlia Bakery, which was the bakery arm of the Tom Douglas restaurant chain.
Right, yeah.
Tom has had, pre-pandemic, about 12 restaurants in the city. And they had a dessert bakery and a bread bakery. I was in the bread bakery, and we did all the bread for all the restaurants, which was about a ton of dough every day.
Good Lord. Wow.
Which was about a dozen different breads for about a dozen restaurants.
Yeah.
And everything, with the exception of a roll divider, everything was done by hand. So it was a great place. It was big enough to be fun, but it wasn't so big that it was too big. You know, it wasn't overwhelming. At Amy's, there was so much flour flying around in the air that we had to wear surgical masks, which of course we all wear now anyway. But, you know, at Dahlia, it wasn't that busy. And the bread chef there at the time was named Wendy Scherer, who was very patient and a very wonderful teacher, because I was still pretty green. I mean, I'd worked at a lot of places and learned a lot of stuff, but I was still pretty green in terms of working in a production bakery. And I started out there mixing, and then I started mixing and shaping, and then I did mixing and shaping and baking, and was there for about 3 years.
Oh, nice.
And it was a great experience. I learned a tremendous amount. You know, it's the sort of advanced education that you only get, you know, after you've gone to school someplace. You only get if you go out and work in industry.
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's for sure.
The only way you get it. Thinking back of, you know, some of the stupid mistakes I made because I was green, it's like, oh my God, did I really do that? But you understand, I mean, one of the things that we all learn as bakers is that you will make mistakes and it's okay. Just learn from them and try not to make them again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if you can recognize it, if you know what you did, there's lots of opportunities to correct it sometimes as well, right? That's part of the skill too, is adapting as you go. You know, I guess if you leave all the yeast out, you got trouble, but you know what I mean? Eh? It's like there's, you know, I've transposed digits a few times with water measurements and stuff, and you're like, oh, okay, I got to fix this up somehow, and you can get there.
Yeah, and it's so wonderful if you're working at a place where you can learn.
Yeah, yep.
That, to me, is the most important thing, is I always wanted to work with people who know more than I do, mm-hmm. because that's how you learn. I mean, to give you an example of a couple of the stupid mistakes that I made.
Sure.
I'll admit to you. One time in school, we were making a seeded bread. So we mixed, I mixed the seeded dough, and then we had, I don't know, some kind of white bread after that. And I forgot to wipe out the bowl.
Right. Yeah.
And I looked at my, you know, the second batch of dough, and I thought, oh my God, it's got sunflower seeds on it.
Yeah.
So that's one of those, you know, oh shit, did I really do that? How could I have been so stupid? But that's the only time I haven't wiped out the bowl since then.
Yep, absolutely.
One time, well, more than once, I made scaling errors because it was confusing. You know, you're doing a bunch of different doughs and all the water looks the same when it's in a bucket. And it took me, you know, several scaling errors and a little bit of time to hit on, you know, my anal retentive system of how I scale, which to this day I put, you know, the formulas in plastic sleeves. And when I scale an item, I mark it off and I set it aside and I label it. So I know what bucket of water goes for what dough. And I've never made a scaling error since. But it took a while to learn that sort of thing.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Like, absolutely. It's,
at the very beginning at Dahlia, we had Guillaume Tech ovens, and it was, there were five tech ovens, five double deck ovens. So you had 10 ovens, and each of them, of course, has a timer. And being still relatively new, I set the timers on all the ovens. And then of course I could never determine what timer was going off for what dough, and it was horribly, horribly loud. And, you know, one time Wendy looked at me and said, "Where are the potato rolls?" And at that same moment, we both smelled the two ovens of potato rolls that were not quite on fire, but darn close to it. So it took making a mistake like that and getting some helpful feedback from Wendy, who, you know, bless her heart, didn't fire me for making such a stupid mistake, to figure out how to work with 10 deck ovens at a bunch of different doughs and different timings. So I would load the top three deck ovens first thing in the morning, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, load the top three deck ovens and set a timer for 45 minutes, which I knew from experience was about how long it took before the loaves got done enough so that I could turn them.
Right.
So I'd set the timer for 45 on the top three, load the bottom two and set that timer for the appropriate amount of time. Same thing. So I only had two timers. Mm-hmm. And I never set any more timers than that. And when the timer went off, I knew which oven it was and I knew what I had to do.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody has their own system for managing timing, but that's what I found worked for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's good. Then, and you're exactly right. You know, you have all the steps that you do that make sense to you, and then making a mistake or having something go wrong is the thing that's going to really reinforce how important that system is, right? You know, in your case, you know, you develop it afterwards in the story, but the same kind of thing. Like, I've run into things where, you know, I'll make a mistake or something is going to go wrong and I'll say, see, that's why I do it the same way all the time. Cause this time I deviated and it got me into trouble, kind of a deal. Yeah. And it really is.
May I backtrack for about a minute? Please. To give you another aspect of this whole story?
Yeah, for sure.
When I was, this would be the summer of 2013. I've been a runner and a cyclist all my life.
So okay.
I and my wife and I were on vacation up in Connecticut. I went cycling one August morning, and it was hot and humid and had a great bike ride. We were sitting by the lake, and I fainted. And my wife was freaked, and I said, well, in my life, I've fainted before because I was dehydrated. I didn't have enough water. Anyway, she said, no, you got to go to the doctor. So I went to the doctor the next day in Manhattan, and she said, I'm going to schedule you for a stress test. And the next day, so I said, well, I can ace this stress test. That'll be easy. It was a stress test and an echocardiogram. And the technician was running her transducer over my chest. And she said, I think we'll wait for the stress test and I'll have you talk to the doctor. And the doctor came in and put down a printout from the echo. And even I could tell that one of those pipelines in my heart was about the size of the Valdez pipeline.
Oh my goodness.
And he said, you have an aortic aneurysm and a leaking aortic heart valve. Get over to NYU Langone Emergency right now. And it was in August and it was a heat wave. He said, don't walk. He said, take a cab. And it turned out that I had the aortic aneurysm and the leaking heart valve. Normally your aorta, where it comes out of your heart, is about the size of a garden hose.
Yeah.
Mine, because of a congenital defect, was about the size of a soda pop can.
Oh, wow.
Normally what happens with cases like that, if there isn't surgical intervention, is that they rupture and the patient dies.
Yep.
90% of the people who are lucky enough to survive long enough to get to a hospital emergency room after dissection still die.
Wow.
So it's pretty serious stuff. It's what killed the comedian John Ritter, if you remember John Ritter, the diplomat Richard Holcomb? I'm blanking on his last name.
That's okay.
Yeah. His aneurysm ruptured when he was sitting in Hillary Clinton's office. Hmm. Anyway, the doctors said, you need surgery right away. And so I had emergency open heart surgery that, thank God, and a wonderful team of doctors was completely successful. And after the surgery, because you have to consider the fact that it might not work.
Yeah.
You might not make it out of the surgery. And so I had always wanted to take the pastry and bread program at the community college where I studied culinary. And my wife and I, you know, took a look at things and I said, you know, I want to go to bread school. I want to go to bread school because I'm still alive And life is short. And if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And so I did. So that's how I happened to, you know, leave broadcasting and go to Bread School.
Yeah.
Which many people would say, well, what a stupid thing to do, because bakers make a lot less than network news anchors.
Oh, goodness, yes. but that's the story. But that's the story that keeps repeating itself, though, is that for whatever reason, the folks like us are like, you know, you change careers because you love what this is that you're doing. And you figure all the rest of that stuff out. But yeah, it's with accepting the heart surgery, with you set that aside, that it's a story I've heard so many times, and I think I've lived myself, but the doing it after heart surgery, I got to ask, like, so what was that like? Cause it's a very physically demanding profession. You know, how did that, what was that like?
The heart surgery or the,
well, but just, I'm talking about baking school, right? So to go to baking school and then work in bakeries and to do that as an older person, having the surgery behind you and stuff, what was that experience like from a physical perspective? Was it a challenge or were you able to just roll with it?
No, in retrospect, it was fine. As my doctor, I went into my cardiologist right after my surgery. The surgery is awful. I mean, they cut your sternum open, then they cut open your heart and they go in and they,
mm-hmm.
And I asked my surgeon, I wrote, because I'm a journalist or was a journalist, I wrote a memoir in the first month of my recovery where I couldn't do much else except try to walk laps in my apartment. And I asked Dr. Galloway, I said, how do you have the balls to cut somebody open and then cut open their heart and fix them? And he said, oh, it's just focus. I was off work for 6 months. There's a long recovery process. I was always active, you know, pre-surgery. And so I started walking and then jogging and then got back into shape. And I still run and cycle every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I was back in shape by that time. But as my cardiologist back in New York said to me when I asked him, I said, why am I so tired if I was in such good shape before the surgery and I had the surgery and now I can barely walk up the stairs? He said, you've been hit by a truck. Yeah. Give yourself some time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So physical fitness is always,
right.
Always good.
Right. And so you were able to keep up with everyone in school and that and working, like, and I, the reason I'm asking is because, like, I'm only 54, but I'm still like, I still wonder sometimes how I do what I do. It's like, how long can I keep on humping these dough tubs around and that kind of stuff, right? When I'm out helping someone else. It's,
I was a radio anchor.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent decades getting up at 1:30 in the morning to be at work at 2:30.
Right.
And take a nap in the afternoon. And then somehow I followed my heart into a profession where, for the first part of my career, at least, I was still getting up at 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Or earlier. And the nap in the afternoon is nice.
Yeah.
Where I work now, fortunately, I don't have to start work until 7:00.
Okay.
But we've been on furlough for the past 6 months anyway, so who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, for sure. So where were you working before the furlough?
I had been at Dahlia for 3 years.
Right.
And had basically learned all I could learn there.
Mm-hmm.
And so in December, I decided I'm going to take a break. We were going to go back to New York to visit family. And after we got back, I went to viennoiserie class at the San Francisco Baking Institute,
okay.
Which was fabulous.
Yeah.
And started looking around for another baking job, hopefully one that would allow me to not have to start work at 2:00 in the morning.
Right.
And so I hired on as the head bread baker for Expedia Group here in Seattle.
Okay.
They built a really fancy New World headquarters on the mm-hmm. Seattle waterfront. They spent $5 million on the kitchen.
Wow.
$5 million is a fabulous kitchen. They opened up what essentially is a fancy food court mm-hmm. with 10 different restaurants in it. So 10 different styles of cuisine. Mm-hmm. And I did the breads for them.
Oh, okay.
And we were open for 2 weeks and then closed because of the pandemic.
Oh, dear.
Oh. So they hope to reopen at some point, but I don't know if they ever will.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cause they're going to have to, it's going to have to get a lot better in terms of the just concentration of people to have a food, you know, even if it's a very expensive food court to have that set up like that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so I don't know what's going to happen.
Ah, shoot. So, that's too bad.
We're all in that odd limbo period where we don't know what is going to happen that's going to directly affect our lives.
Right, right. And in the States, like furlough, that means, like, my understanding is you're kind of on your own, right? Or is Expedia able to help you out at all? like I know what they do for folks in Canada, but it sounds like, what are you guys getting, like $600 and a pat on the back, or how does that work?
No. It's... Most bakeries, the few bakeries that are still open are mostly working on a takeout sort of basis.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So they've cut their staff
totally
drastically. Yeah. We had about, I think there are 60, maybe 70 people in our kitchen, mm-hmm. not all in the bakery, of course, but throughout the whole
right.
thing. And, the way many of the tech companies and universities in the Seattle area manage their food service is to subcontract it with a food service contractor.
Yes.
Which is I had never heard of until a year ago, but it's a very efficient way to run a place. And Expedia, bless their corporate hearts, has deep pockets. And so they are still paying those of us who are on the reduced staff list, our full salary.
Oh, wow. Oh,
at least for you. At least for a time.
Yeah.
It's the most remarkable thing I've ever heard of.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, good for you. That's great.
I'm surprised that they've continued it this long. It's very, very generous of them.
Yeah.
I have no idea how long it will continue. I miss my 2-deck ovens.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
They were brand new and they were so nice.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, and just the excitement over starting something new like that and getting it going and then to only be able to do it for a couple of weeks is,
yeah.
That's
it wasn't,
tough.
We didn't have a large bread operation. It was a bread bakery and pastry bakery.
Sure.
Oh, and there were, how many of us in the bakery? 4 or 5, I think, total mm-hmm. in the bakery. We did about 5 or 6 different breads, so a fairly light load.
Yeah.
Croissants and a whole host of, you know, pies and tarts and cookies and muffins and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll see. In the meantime, I'm baking at home.
Good for you. Good for you. Just for you and the family, or are you sending it out around the neighborhood?
Well, out around the neighborhood.
Yeah, good for you.
You know, I look at my freezer and I say, no, I can't bake any more bread until I eat some of this bread.
Yep, yeah, exactly.
But if I want to make more bread, I know where I can take it and it'll be appreciated.
That's right. No, that's exactly it. It's when I get the bug here, it's like, okay, time to start knocking on some neighbors' doors because my freezer is full.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if there was one thing, I love your podcast, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
I love hearing bakers' stories because mm-hmm. the format allows you to explore a whole lot of issues with people that we normally wouldn't get a chance to
sure.
meet. And so it's been wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
I think if there was one thing that I'd like to pass along to bakers or anybody who's thinking about baking is how important it is to really follow your heart. if you look deep inside yourself and say, this is what I want to do, you'll do it.
Yeah.
You know, get the education and the training that you need, put in the work that you need to put in, and it's very, very satisfying. I love it when people look at a loaf of my bread and say, wow, that really looks nice. Or the bread you gave us was so good. You know, nobody ever said that after I did an hourly newscast for CBS.
That's right. That's right. No, it's direct, honest feedback. You know, it's a beautiful thing for sure. So cool. Well, I'm glad you told me that you're 70, because I wouldn't have believed it in a minute.
You're looking so kind.
For 70, 70 with heart surgery and 15 years baking. It's like, oh my God, you're looking great. So,
what next? Is that your question?
What's the timeline like? How long are you going to keep doing this?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate in that I'm healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason why I can't continue to keep doing this for some time. I mean, I wake up every morning, literally every morning, and my first waking thoughts are to thank God and my surgeons for another day.
Yeah.
And this is all I have, is this one day. So I'll make the most of it. I've been to France, I think, four or five times. Yeah. I would love to go to France for 6 months or a year and spend, you know, a month at a different bakery, just have the experience and to have the learning.
Yeah.
And to improve my intermediate French. as far as, you know, working a job with all the things that are required there, you know, I'll keep at it for a while. Depends on how I feel.
Yeah.
I have thought of everybody knows about the massive interest in sourdough baking.
Yeah.
On the internet. So I have thought, and most bakeries, many bakeries and most culinary schools have an ancillary business of, you know, giving baking lessons, that sort of thing. So I thought about trying to work something out along those lines.
Nice.
You know, where my workload would be less, I'd still get to have my hands on the dough. And it's fun to show people the way things work.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is a fellow here in Seattle, runs a pie shop called A La Mode Pies. And I worked for him for about 3 months, simply because I went into his pie shop one day and I thought, oh, this is cute.
Yeah.
And I love pies and doing pie dough. And I wanted to learn how to really get good at rolling out pie dough. And so I worked for him for about 3 months and learned how to, got really good at rolling out pie dough. But he runs, civilian baking classes, baking classes for the public.
Sure.
A couple of times a week or so. And it's a great profit center for his bakery.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great profit center for his bakery. People pay a lot of money to learn how to, you know, mix flour, water, salt, and sugar.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's absolutely right. Like my friend Martin, that's, I was helping him bake on the weekend because he had a big order coming up. But he teaches, he's a former instructor, like culinary instructor, that right. built a bakery space attached to his house. And he teaches classes. He can teach, you know, well, in COVID times now, four or five people at a time. It used to be, you know, 10 in the space. And like he's booked solid because people just want to learn whatever the topic is that he's teaching, everything from the business side to let's do some Christmas baking, folks are all over it, you know? And so, yeah,
and the really nice thing about that, is that you're helping somebody acquire a skill.
Yeah.
They will have for the rest of their lives.
Yep.
Will yield, you know, great enjoyment and satisfaction.
Yeah. Well, and taking the mystery away from it, you know, like when I was growing up, it was always, you know, my grandmother had the touch and my mom never had the touch. Right. And it's like, yeah. Well, maybe I have the touch, but it sure helped to understand what was going on, you know, to actually understand the science and take the magic out was a good thing, you know?
If I can, let me add two little
please things. Do.
Because we're always in, when you're talking about, you know, the quality and somebody making something. I remember when I was in culinary school, I think it was Antoine Carême, one of those old French guys, who said something along the lines of, you never really know how to cook something until you've cooked it 1,000 times.
Sure.
And then I saw an interview with Jacques Pepin, in which he was, the subject was, you know, what do you think of all the young star chefs on TV? And he said, you know, all of that is fine, but he had the greatest respect for the line cook in his French restaurant that banged out the same dishes every night, and every one of them was perfect.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's a testament to the difficulty and the value of the skill and the tradecraft, which I have great admiration for.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you on that one for sure. There's so many things from the rhythm of doing that work to the care and attention that you can give, even when you're working at speed, is something that's really cool about what we do. You know, it's, you know, if I'm even rounding, like I was rounding bagels with Martin and we're doing, you know, 300 or 400 bagels, just the two of us. And it's like, it's nice when they're all the same. Like I enjoy that, you know, like just that ability, we can work fast. And then you look at the trays and you're like, this is some good stuff that we're making.
The bakery ballet is very, very interesting, because that's something that you have to learn in addition to how to bake, is you have to learn how to work in a bakery.
You betcha. Yep.
One of the guys at Dahlia when I was first starting there, and I was a little bit overwhelmed by the volume that we were doing, he said to me, look, don't touch shit twice. I thought to myself, oh, you know, that makes sense. Yep. You know, if I just touch it once, it's faster.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go. Cool. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to chat, for sure. I'm inspired by your story, actually. I think a lot of folks that are listening to this will be as well, both because everybody, or I don't know everybody, a lot of people dream about making the switch, and sometimes they get intimidated by the work involved or the effort involved, or, you know, oh, have I left it too long or that kind of a thing. And I keep saying, like, no, you can do this, you know, and it's so nice to talk to you and hear about, you know, the long and successful career you had, and then the second one that you built, you know. And this is, I don't know. I find it very inspirational, and hopefully, if I'm ever allowed to travel south, I have a bunch of people to see in Seattle, and I'll be looking you up for sure when I get down there.
Well, you're entirely welcome to come down. Give me a call when you do.
Yeah, for sure.
And, if we're out of the most severe part of the lockdown, I'll show you around.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thanks so much, Stephen. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Best of luck with your podcast.
Thanks.
You could probably find some way to monetize it and make lots and lots of money.
Well, I don't know about lots and lots, but I got some ideas for some. So, so we'll see how it goes. Thank you.
And there you have it. What a chat, hey? kind of interesting, I have to say. I've been accused of being a bit of a chatty guy, but it is really nice for me to talk with a professional broadcaster like Stephen. Yeah, yes, he's retired, but you could tell pretty quick that here's a fella that has spent years and years and years in the business. Because, well, first off, you know, he starts off asking me questions. I thought it was lovely, but, you know, I don't want to blather on about myself too much, but it was nice. It was a good context setting. Got into it really amazing to me that it's inspiring to me, because there are days when I'm not super happy with myself that I think, oh my God, this is hard work. How much longer am I going to be able to bake at a production level? You know, and I'm not doing it all the time now. And so when I go up and see my friend Martin and work with him, and it's like after a while, those dough tubs start to feel a little heavy, and they're smaller than I'm used to, and still they're a little heavy. And my gosh, I sweat a lot. And what's going on? And so it's inspiring to me to talk to folks that are older than me and more experienced than me and are still going strong and are still loving the craft and loving the profession. I just think that's awesome. And so thank you, Stephen, for coming on the show. Thank you for sharing your story. I know you've inspired me, and I'm willing to bet that you've inspired a lot of other people that are listening to this as well through your whole career, but and also through your attitude, I guess, or your posture when it comes to baking. I love it. So thanks for that. And I hope we do get to connect up, you know, when travel is allowed again. So I hope you enjoyed this chat. I hope you maybe in a perfect world, you've now, maybe this episode is like the second one you listen to today, or maybe the fourth one this week, because it's episode 110. So there's a lot of back catalog, as they say, right? And I hope you've listened to a couple. And if you have, I'd love it if you just reflected on the breadth of people in this community of bakers and bakery owners that exist in the world right now. I think it's amazing. I think it's amazing how we can talk, how I get to talk to two people in, you know, baking out of their kitchen, like I did last week with the folks in Boulder. And then here's a guy that's worked in some of the largest bakeries and the most famous bakeries in New York and Seattle. And that's just awesome. And next week, I don't want to foreshadow too much, but we're going to talk to somebody that's baking in a radically different situation than either of these two folks. And I just think that's really neat, because we all have so much in common, even though what we're doing is different and where we're working is different. And I just think that's really, really cool. Really cool that we can all come together like this. So thanks so much. If you want to hear those past episodes and you're like, Mark, how do I do that? You go to riseuppod.com. That's where you go. And all 110 episodes are there. There's a little checkbox when every time I publish an episode that says, how long do you want to keep this episode available? And I say forever, because if you've just heard the show for the first time, if this is your first episode, there's 110 to listen to. And you can listen to them all. You can go back to the very first one if you want. I sound different. I hope I sound different, because I sounded pretty nervous in that first one. But they're all there. So go for it. And if you like what you're hearing and you want to support the show, I'd love it. Nothing would make me happier than if you were willing to support the show. On riseuppod.com, there's a lovely little blue button that says support the show. And if you want to leave a donation to keep the show going, I'd appreciate it. Thanks very much. There are several people. There are well over a dozen people now that are regular monthly supporters who donate a little bit every month, you know, a couple bucks every month. And it really makes a huge difference for me. It all adds up. And when I get that email that says, you know, oh, she's donated again, I just, my heart swells. Thank you so much. Thanks so much. We have another show coming up next week. I can hardly wait for next Wednesday. Have a great week. Bake lots. Stay safe and healthy. Happy baking. Bye-bye.